MacCast, Friday, August 5th, 2016. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Glad to have you back here with me for another episode. We've got quite a number of things to talk about this week, starting off with some security encryption, black hat, espionage. No, I don't know. There's been some hacking going on and some various things surrounding hacking that we're going to talk about. We're going to talk a little bit about next generation Apple Watch. We've got sightings now, spottings of supposedly what Apple's going to do to solve the no headphone jack in the iPhone 7 problem. We'll talk about that a little bit. And updates on the iPhone 7 itself, a little bit of international news, and then what's happening with Apple's next generation Apple TV plans. We've got all of that and then some great feedback. Going to talk about a new Apple commercial and what that maybe means or doesn't mean for the future of computers. Mac HomeKit automation, got a question about that from one of you, and going to dig into a little bit of a new feature that's in macOS Sierra, the optimized storage. I've been curious about that, so I dove in a little bit, and I'm going to share my findings with you. And then I have a great thing of the moment for you this week. So like I said, lots of things to jump in and talk about, but before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Eero. Now, think for just a minute how much we depend on Wi-Fi now and the reliability of our Wi-Fi. It's not just web surfing anymore, right? You've got cloud storage, maybe backup. You're using it for your entertainment. You've got various connected devices in your house, maybe a light, a thermostat, a doorbell, a coffee maker, maybe even your fridge. More and more things getting hooked up to that. And when we have issues or trouble with Wi-Fi, it's like we just had our power cut, right? You're totally cut off, and you don't want to have to deal with hassles of resetting your gear, but we've all gone through that. I've covered complex topics on this show about how to deal with Wi-Fi issues, range extending, getting to different parts of your house, dealing with dead zones. What a hassle. Well, that is where Eero comes in. Eero is a simple Wi-Fi system that's easy to set up and takes away a lot of those hassles. The way it works is it's actually multiple devices, multiple Wi-Fi devices that work together in a way that blankets your entire house with fast, reliable Wi-Fi. And it works differently than your typical range extenders because each Eero is its own Wi-Fi hotspot. It's not just doing single hops. It's not requiring separate SSIDs. A typical Eero unit can cover about 1,000 square feet of your house, and you can add Eeros as you need it to get additional coverage. So you can start out with a few, add more, and get more and more coverage as you need it. And best of all, each unit comes with its own 30-day money-back guarantee. So you can always return one if you find out that you don't need it. They actually sent me a system to try out, and I have to tell you, it's been amazing. One of my favorite parts was the setup. Super easy. It was really, truly plug and play. It was a three-unit system. You take the units out, you plug them in the different areas of your house. I set up three different zones to cover everything, and then you use the app to do the setup, and it walks you through the entire process. It can literally be done in a matter of minutes, and so far, for me, the whole system has proven incredibly reliable. I've not had to deal with things like slowdowns or dead zone areas or having to do constant resets to get my Wi-Fi back up to speed and working the way that it was when I originally set it up. And another advantage of the Eero system is they look great. They're these sleek little white low-profile boxes, and they don't have a bunch of antennas and things sticking out of them. You can actually have them on a shelf or in a visible area of your house. You're not having to hide them behind things or sort of disguise them because they're this ugly Wi-Fi range extender. I think it's a really great product. And best of all, there's a great offer for MacCast listeners from Eero. You get free overnight shipping if you visit eero.com, that's eero.com, and at checkout select overnight shipping and then just enter the code MACCAST, you're going to get your shipping for free. So you can check out the product. Like I said, it has a 30-day money-back guarantee. Try it out. But I'm getting great full bandwidth coverage in all the various zones, and the setup was dead simple. So check it out, eero.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MACCAST. Okay, now say it with me. Hacking, encryption, and black hats, oh my. Hacking, encryption, and black hats, oh my. Yeah, we're going to talk a lot about security this week. There's been a number of stories, none of them very big, but a number of security, encryption, hacking-related stories that surfaced this week, and I wanted to draw your attention to a couple of them. The first one that I ran across was something related to deleted iMessages, and security researcher Jonathan Zdarsky discovered that even when you delete your iMessages, they're actually not deleted. And actually what he was looking at was WhatsApp, but he pointed out that the same bug, the same issues exists in the iMessage app, probably a number of other messaging apps, because the root of the issue is a common problem with any app that uses a SQLite database. And most iOS apps, that's what they use for their data storage. And what he says is that those apps can actually leave a forensic trace behind, because instead of actually deleting and sort of cleaning up after themselves, I think he calls it vacuuming the data records, what happens is the records are just added to a free list, meaning that those records don't actually get overwritten until the database actually needs to use more storage. So they're kind of sitting there. This is a similar thing with hard drives, right? Where the data doesn't actually get deleted, especially SSDs these days. They sort of get marked for deletion. And unless you have some software or some other processes to go through and actually write data over top of those, that data can be recovered with forensic software. And probably one of the reasons the operating system and the apps are working like this, he speculates, is that it's to save wear and tear on flash storage, because flash storage has a limited number of read-write cycles that has to do with longevity of the storage itself. So generally, you don't want to be doing a bunch of read-writes. And it's really this problem, while it's interesting to think about and it sounds like a big deal, oh my gosh, you know, someone could go back and forensically restore my iMessages, it's probably not a big deal for most users. Unless your data records are subpoenaed, maybe for a court case, or if your iCloud account gets hacked, because if you use iCloud backup, the files are stored in, you know, that data is also stored, those database, MySQL-like database files are also stored in your iCloud backups. So if someone could hack into your account, they could potentially get in there and maybe, again, use forensic tools and methodologies to get at that data. And Apple does encrypt the iCloud data, but they currently can decrypt those iCloud backups. So they've already said that they plan to change that in the future, but it's not that way right now. So again, not a really big issue unless somehow your data is going to get compromised. Somebody would have to have access to your phone or access to your data in your messaging app. But just something to be aware of, and an interesting story that came up security related this week. Another thing that happened this week is there was the Panju jailbreak hack that was detailed. Some who had used the Panju jailbreak had reported that they suddenly were getting or seeing unauthorized access to one or more of their online accounts, specifically Facebook, PayPal, or people accessing their credit or debit accounts after they applied the hack. Now, it looks like the compromise might have come through something called PP Helper, which apparently is a tool that's provided by the Chinese company 25PP, who was hosting the Panju jailbreak files. Now, I'm personally not a jailbreaker. I don't know if you are, but I wanted to bring this up in case people were running across this. Now, the hacks seem to be mostly coming from Taiwan, Vietnam, Beijing, and other places in China. And there is a US-hosted version of the Panju jailbreak, and that was signed using a different method, and as far as I can tell, doesn't seem to be impacted, at least according to the reports I'd been reading. The Panju team actually denies any involvement in the hacks, because some people were speculating Maybe it was a problem there. And most sources that I've checked with, and I trust them, say, you know, the Panju jailbreak team, the people who write this jailbreak, are actually, you know, pretty reputable developers. They've been doing this kind of stuff for a while, and it's highly unlikely that that's what's going on. It's really looking like this was some sort of hack perpetrated through this PP helper tool, or a variant of it that's on this Chinese hosting company site that was hosting the files for the Panju jailbreak. Now, I'm also bringing this up because Apple noted that they actually fixed the what they called the Panju jailbreak exploit in an update that came out to iOS this week, iOS 9.3.4, and it was a security update. And while that sounds like maybe it's, you know, dealing with this Panju jailbreak hack, I think what we're really talking about is two different things. Apple sees jailbreak exploits, or the sort of hacks that jailbreaks use to do their stuff, as holes in the Apple operating system, security holes. So it sounds like they patched that up so you could not apply, if you do run iOS 9.3.4, the Panju jailbreak is not going to work. Although I do think I saw a report just today on Twitter, late this afternoon, that it looks like another jailbreak is surfacing. So if you're a jailbreaker, at least temporarily, you might want to avoid the iOS 9.3.4 update. Now, again, I'm not a jailbreaker. I don't really advise people to jailbreak. I don't even know why people would want to jailbreak anymore, other than you can do some cool custom visual hacks. And there's some, you know, some people like to tweak around on their iPhones. I'm not that kind of person, and I worry about these sorts of things where it opens up some security holes and some back ends potentially for hackers to take advantage of. So, you know, jailbreaking at your own risk, but that's what's been kind of going on in the jailbreak community a little bit. Another thing that's been happening quite a bit are some new phishing scams related to people trying to get at your data after stealing your iPhone, or actually trying to exploit you to try and ransomware some money from you. There was a Dutch site this week called Apple Tips that reported they were seeing some instances where hackers were using compromised iCloud accounts to go in and lock iOS devices remotely and then send ransomware messages to their owners, asking them to pay money to have their device unlocked. Now, knowledgeable and sort of tech-savvy users will realize that you have the device in your hand, so your device hasn't been stolen, nothing has been compromised. Even if you go into your iCloud account and remotely lock your device, you can simply unlock it by putting in your passcode and get back into it. And at that point, you'd probably want to go in and change your iCloud password, because in order for this hack, this ransomware trick to work, you would have already had to have had your iCloud account compromised. So these guys were getting into people's iCloud accounts some other way and then try to use that to take advantage of them and extort money. I would also recommend that you consider using two-factor authentication, because even there, if somehow your iCloud credentials became compromised, you would still have an extra line of defense. They wouldn't be able to get in without using the two-factor authentication codes, and they wouldn't have access to that. So that would even further protect your iCloud account. Now, another scam that's going on has to do with a lost phone. This came out in a report this week. There was a reporter, I think in Italy, he had had his phone stolen, and it was locked, so he wasn't really worried about it, and he was going to use Find My iPhone to kind of track it. But the thieves were smart. They immediately turned off the device, so he couldn't immediately use Find My iPhone, but he did enable the feature that said, hey, notify me when this phone comes online and see if I can track it that way. Well, it seems what's going on is smart thieves are realizing that a number of people will use this feature. And what they're doing is they're using social engineering and looking online to try and find your information, figure out what your email address is, and then they send a fake Apple-looking message that says, hey, your device has been located, click this link, log into your iCloud account. And what they set up is a fake iCloud login. So when you click the link, you go to a site that looks very much like an Apple website. It looks like iCloud.com. But what it's really doing is spoofing that. It's giving a fake login, and then it's storing your login credentials so that the thieves can then get into your iCloud account turn off Find My iPhone, turn off your security features, and then they'll have an unlocked phone that they can sell on the secondary market. It's a pretty sophisticated and smart hack, so you have to be paying attention. Luckily, this reporter, when he received the message, they also sent him a text message, and in the text message, you could see that the URL was not necessarily a legitimate Apple URL. Also, when he was on the page, there was not a lock. It was not it's not SSL or HTTPS encrypted, and that was also kind of a giveaway that this was going on. But you know, hackers and thieves are getting a lot smarter about these phishing scams and looking at ways to kind of socially engineer and lure our information out of us, because Apple and everybody have made us more aware of, hey, we've got to use better passwords, we've got to use two-factor authentication. So they're looking for other ways to get in. And so, you know, I want those of you in the MacCast community to be aware that this is going on so that you can protect yourselves. Not only that, so you can share this information with family members who may be a little less tech savvy and might fall prey to this kind of attack. And then lastly, Apple is doing their part to further increase their security and protection against hacking. They actually presented at the Black Hat Security Conference this week, which is actually a bit of news in and of itself, because Apple has never done that before. They haven't historically been very open about what they're doing with security surrounding iOS and Mac devices. So they actually gave a presentation at the Black Hat Conference, and right before that, they announced that they're going to start offering bug bounties in amounts from between $25,000 to $200,000 US for people who find exploits in macOS or iOS. And so if you find an exploit, you can report that to Apple. If they verify it, you can potentially get some money for exposing that and credit for finding the bug. Now, at first, Apple is going to be offering these bounties to just a select group of security researchers. They're going to start this in September, but they do plan to expand the program over time. And Apple is giving the researchers the option when they earn a bounty to actually have that money donated to a charity that they choose. And then in some instances, Apple, at their discretion, may even match that contribution, so they can double the amount that they might get if they're willing to give it to charity. And the whole point of all of this is having more eyes on what's going on in the operating system, having more security researchers and people banging away at the operating system, and giving them incentives to do so, financial incentives to do so, will hopefully help Apple find more exploits and bugs and holes before the bad guys can, better protecting all of us. And I think this is a very good thing. Other companies have had sort of hacking bounties out there for a while. Apple's a little bit late to this party, but it's good to see them moving forward. And it's good to see them being more public and open about their security efforts by, you know, participating in conferences publicly like Black Hat. So some good news on the encryption, hacking, and security front. I know we gave you a couple bad stories, but let's finish it up with a little good one here. Now, I'm not sure if I completely agree that the next generation Apple Watch is coming this fall. There's a number of people that think we're going to see Apple Watch 2 at some sort of announcement in September. But here's kind of the latest information on what people are expecting we might see if that happens. DigiTimes is claiming that they have a source at the Apple Watch touchscreen supplier who told them that they recently run into issues with production on what they're calling a one glass solution OLED touch panel. And they're saying this is going to result potentially in the next generation Apple Watch being available in lower yield. So it may be in high demand. I think it's always going to be in high demand and hard to get a hold of, but they may have some production issues that may slow getting units out as quickly as Apple might want. Now, what's more interesting about this is the idea of this one glass solution, because the current version of the Apple Watch uses a technology that is a glass on glass solution, meaning that the capacitive stack of materials is actually two pieces of glass. And so moving to a one glass solution would potentially allow Apple to make the Apple Watch to be thinner, or possibly allow them a little more space for a little bit larger battery. And battery life is the one thing that, if you ask most Apple Watch users, they really want to see Apple focusing on for the next version. And I think that's also something that Apple has been very interested in. Now, other rumors surrounding the Apple Watch 2 is that it may have a screen with better outdoor visibility. We've also heard these rumors that it may finally build in GPS, which is great news for athletes and runners and people who work out, and also just for mapping in general. It could be a little bit more autonomous on the watch. And we're also hearing reports that Apple may try to build in 3G cellular data capabilities. And if you're thinking 3G, why wouldn't they do LTE? Again, it's all about the power stuff. And 3G would be enough to get the little bits of data that an Apple Watch might need to be more autonomous. You could still make phone calls. You could still do video things, photos. All those things would work with a 3G cellular data. You don't need to have the highest speed. Because again, if you remember, the data that's on the Apple Watch for most apps typically is just little bits of data. You're not doing the same kinds of interactions that you might do on an iOS device. So I think that might be viable. Those would be great updates, but all of those things are another reason why I think Apple might not be quite ready to put Apple Watch out in the fall. I'm thinking maybe more likely spring of next year when we'll see the next generation of Apple Watch. But who knows, Apple could surprise us, and there are a lot of people who think we might see that this fall. So iPhone 7 rumors really heating up. We're expecting Apple to do a launch event sometime in early September for the next generation of the iPhone. And of course, unless you've probably been living in a cave somewhere, you probably know that one of the big news, I was going to say new features, but it's really one of the features that Apple is going to potentially take away from the iPhone 7 is the headphone jack, the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack. And there's been a lot of speculation. Well, if they take that away, what are they going to do for headphones for the ear pods that are in the box? Are they going to go with wireless? Are they going to go with a wired solution? Well, a couple videos hit the web this week claiming to show off Apple's solution, and it seems to be a set of lightning ear pods. Now, the first video that I saw, it looked like it might be a little fake to me. The connector just looked a little bit too flat and too long. But then there was another video from another source that showed up that looked a little bit more convincing, and it had some higher res images. And you know, that said, as far as the longer and fatter connector, because both of them kind of had this longer lightning connector, I would imagine that may be for additional processing, audio processing electronics that might be built into the connector along with the electronics for the lightning connector. So it seems viable. And actually, John Gruber kind of gave his theory on, you know, if the iPhone 7 ships without a headphone jack, what is Apple going to put in the box? And he kind of gave five different options. He said, you know, they could be wireless earbuds. They could be wireless earbuds with a headphone adapter. And I think we talked about the headphone adapter on the last episode of the MacCast. Some people are speculating Apple might include a lightning to 3.5 millimeter adapter. So that's what he's talking about there. So wireless earbuds with an adapter. Lightning earbuds with an adapter, or the existing 3.5 millimeter jack ear pods with an adapter. And Gruber says he's hoping for wireless earbuds, but he doesn't think that Apple would ever ship an adapter in the box. And I tend to agree with that because of the logic that he puts forth. You know, if Apple puts an adapter in the box, they're sort of in a way admitting that the 3.5 millimeter jack is still needed by most buyers of the iPhone. They're saying, okay, here's an iPhone. We know we took the 3.5 millimeter jack away, but we know that you still need it. And really the marketing message they probably want to deliver is that's a connector of the past. We're moving forward. Lightning or wireless are the technologies moving forward. And so it could be, you know, wireless ear pods. But just based on the videos and the more recent rumors we've been seeing, I'm thinking Apple's leaning toward doing lightning ear pods in the box. And that's probably what's going to be in there. There's probably still going to be an adapter, a 3.5 millimeter adapter, because there's a lot of those headphones out there. Some people have invested in pretty high-end, very expensive earbuds and headphones, and they're not going to want to just have to dump those overnight. So Apple will have an adapter. It's probably going to be a separate purchase available in store, same time as launch. I'm guessing $20 US for the adapter. It could be $29. I'm hoping that they don't go to that high a price point, because I think there'll be a little bit of outrage with that. And, you know, even with the Lightning EarPods looking more and more likely, there's still a lot of people out there. There's still a lot of rumors that say, no, Apple's going with a wireless solution. And Forbes this week reported that Apple has a project where they're working on wireless earbuds that are using a Apple-designed, a custom-designed low-power Bluetooth chip. One of the complaints about wireless wireless headphones right now is the Bluetooth technology and battery life. Those are kind of the two big complaints, that the Bluetooth technology isn't robust enough. And they're saying this is Bluetooth, but I've heard other people throw out theories that, you know, maybe Apple would even develop a wireless headphone technology that's not Bluetooth, that's some other technology that's maybe proprietary, more reliable. I'd like to see them stick with an open source solution, but if you can't get the Bluetooth audio technology to be really reliable, work over a good distance, and have good battery life, you may have to look at some other solution. But needless to say, the Forbes piece is saying a custom Bluetooth chip designed by Apple. And the piece also notes that Apple really has battery life on a pair of wireless ear pods as a key focus, and that they may be using technology from Passive Semiconductor, which is a company that Apple acquired back in 2013 to help with the battery life issue. They say the earbuds have been in development for, quote, a few years, and they do think that they may be launched in September. Now, that said, I will point out that we often hear about Apple technologies and prototypes, things that they're working on that never actually become actual products. So we can get a report that Apple is working on wireless ear pods or something like that, but they try a bunch of things, they try some custom chipsets, they never get it sort of performing or working the way that they want, and they maybe scrap it and go with another solution. So I think, again, because we've seen these wired leaked ear pods from two different sources, I think that what has been going on is Apple's been wanting to do wireless, but maybe they haven't been exactly happy with the results or the battery life, or some other issue came to play and a wired solution was kind of the fallback. A little bit easier to do, a little bit cheaper probably for them to produce. They'll make a little bit more money on each iPhone that they sold. So I think ultimately that's what we're going to be getting in the box. I do think they will potentially offer a wireless, I don't know if it will be an EarPod solution. I think they may, if they're going to do a higher end sold separately wireless headphone or wireless earbud, I think they may do it as a separate accessory but sold through their Beats line. That seems to make a little more sense to me, but all of the rumors and reports we've been hearing about this project seem to be related to wireless EarPods. So they could still do an Apple-branded wireless EarPod. We've seen them do wireless Bluetooth things before. They had the little Bluetooth headset for the iPhone a few years back. I don't think it ever sold very well, but you know, Apple's not afraid of doing a separate accessory like that. So I'm not sure we'll see a wireless EarPod in September, but or September or October, but maybe sometime next year that could come to fruition. But that's kind of the latest on the iPhone 7 headphone situation. Now, moving on to the color of the next iPhone, that's been another story of deep speculation. There's been a couple of rumors floating around that the iPhone 7 may bring a new color choice replacing the space gray. Now, the two most talked about colors are space black, just like the Apple Watch, or a new, what they're calling space blue color, kind of this deep, dark blue color, almost a navy blue. Very similar, I think, to the midnight blue leather iPhone case that they have. And I personally would love to see the space blue version. Although this week there was purportedly a mute switch that surfaced that was in space black. They said was for the new iPhone 7. And I'm thinking that's more likely to be the color that Apple goes with. Again, matching the Apple Watch, I think, makes sense. They'd had troubles with doing the black color in the past. If you remember, I think the iPhone 5 had a space black or a black color. I don't remember if Apple specifically called it space black, but it sort of had some color flaking, scratching issues, and they went back to the space gray. So maybe they're ready to go back to that deep space black color. And I think that looks really nice as well. But some people have done mock-ups with that space blue, and I think it looks just gorgeous. So I'd love to see that, but I'm not expecting it. Some other iPhone rumors. We got more confirmation this week that the iPhone 7 Plus may come with 3 gigabytes of RAM. This came via DigiTimes. In the past, we had KGI securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo claiming twice that the 5.5-inch iPhone would ship with 3 gigabytes of RAM. My guess is that Apple's going to put more RAM in that model because of the other rumor about the dual-lens camera system. I think they're going to need a little bit of extra juice to do some higher-end image processing with those dual lenses, and that extra RAM is going to come in handy that way. And then iPhone app sales are going very well, according to Tim Cook. He says in July it was the best month ever for App Store developer payouts. He did this in a tweet. He said that Apple has now paid out a total of over $50 billion to developers. And if you remember in the last earnings call, he noted that the App Store revenue had a growth rate of 27% year over year. And he also noted that the average amount spent per customer reached its highest, the highest level the company had ever seen in the past quarter. So a lot more people buying apps and making more money off of apps, which I think is ultimately a good thing for the app ecosystem. As far as why July was such a great month for Apple, well, many were quick to point out, and probably accurately, that the release of Pokemon Go might have shifted the July figures a little bit higher. If you remember, Pokemon Go was released on July 5th. It's still going strong, getting a lot of buzz, a lot of people playing it, and a big component of that game is the in-app purchases. And estimates have said that across all the platforms, Pokemon Go could be making about $10 million a day. So just speculating, even if Apple was only getting 1.5 to 2 million of that per week, that's a lot of in-app purchase revenue. And they're very likely getting more than that. So I would speculate that Apple is maybe making $1 million to $2 million a week off of just Pokemon in-app purchases. And that's certainly nothing to scoff at, and may have pushed those numbers up in July. And finally, as I've said with the iPhone 7, parts and component leaks are becoming a lot more prominent as we get closer to September, when Apple's expected to announce the iPhone 7. Mostly things I think are lining up with a lot of the rumors we've covered previously. So no big design changes, and that seems to be confirmed by a set of images released by Sonny Dixon this week. He's a known iPhone leaker. He's been very accurate with his iPhone leaks in the past. He posted a couple of images of a rose gold and white iPhone 7 and iPhone 7 Plus, and it pretty much confirms what we've known. Design and size being the same, the moving of the antennas, the antenna lines more to the edges of the iPhone, and getting rid of the line across the back. On the iPhone 7, you've got a larger camera hole, and you've got the dual lenses with the oval hole for the camera lenses on the iPhone 7 Plus, and there's a smoother, more integrated camera bump. It's kind of, I call it a flange. I don't know what you'd call it. It just kind of smooths up rather than looking like the camera was sort of inset with that chamfered beveled edge. It's more integrated into the back design of the case. Also in the Sonny Dixon images, it does look like there's still a physical home button. There had been some rumors that Apple may do away with an actual physical clickable button and go with more of a touch, force touch kind of button. But that doesn't look to be the case, at least in the Sonny Dixon leak. And of course, no headphone jack, what looks like stereo speakers, although that's hard to confirm. There's at least equal speaker holes on each side of the lightning port, you know, sort of alluding that there might be stereo sound, which is another rumor we'd been hearing about for a while. And there had been a few other leaks that showed an iPhone 7 supposedly with a smart connector. But the one from Sonny Dixon did not have a smart connector, and I still don't think Apple is going to put a smart connector on the next iPhone. I think, again, it might have been something they were playing around with in the early prototyping stage, but I really can't see a reason for that being in there. Some people have said, well, maybe it's another option for charging so that you can charge and use maybe a set of Lightning headphones at the same time. I think Apple is going to go with a wireless charging solution, an optional wireless charging solution. So you can charge wirelessly or through the Lightning connector, and that sort of solves that problem. So I think that's what's going to be happening. Now, of course, timing being what it is, as we get close to this event, we're also starting to hear people talk about supply constraints and that when the iPhone 7 comes out, it's going to be in short supply, demand is going to be high. Again, I think this is a safe rumor to throw out there because this happens every time we get a new iPhone, right? But analysts seem to think the iPhone 7 Plus may have a few larger constraints than the iPhone 7. And the two reasons being that there is just currently higher demand for larger smartphone panels, not just by Apple, but you know, across the board. Larger smartphones are very popular, so the few vendors that create the screens, they are only able to produce so many panels at a time. Now, Apple is usually pretty good about locking up their contracts and making sure they have good supply in the supply chain moving into a release, so I don't expect that to be a huge issue. But there's also that new dual lens camera system on the iPhone 7 Plus, and that's probably going to be a little bit trickier component. It's a new component. Anytime you have a new component for an iPhone, there can be production delays and issues, yield issues and things like that, and that may slow the rollout of the number of units that are available at launch time. So Apple will be struggling with that. I don't think it's any big surprise, but they usually do okay. And usually if they sort of stumble at launch, they're pretty good at ramping up pretty quickly. Apple's always been very good at managing the supply chain and sort of getting the phones out to those people who want them. So I don't think it's going to be a huge issue this time around. And again, I think it's also related to the iPhone 7. You know, Apple's hoping that it's going to help with its sales numbers going into the end of the year. Apple's been relying kind of on new models and emerging markets, most recently India, to kind of keep the iPhone money coming in. But we all know that iPhone sales year over year are starting to slow down a bit. And India still seems to be a trouble spot for Apple, even though they focused on it pretty heavily. Tim Cook has said they're in India, they're in there to stay, they're going to keep working on it. But there's a lot of price sensitivity in the Indian market. And we got a report from Strategy Analytics this week that kind of confirmed Apple's continued struggles in India. They say that iPhone sales fell 35% rather in India from 2015 to 2016. So over the past year, Apple's seen sales decline of 35% of iPhone in India. They also say that that puts Apple's share of the market in India, the smartphone market in India, down from 4.5% last year to just 2.4% this year. And in India, Android now controls about 97% of the Indian mobile market. So Apple continues to struggle there. I think new iPhone's going to help. The iPhone 7 coming out, I think the iPhone 7 is going to sell well for Apple, but I still expect to see a decline in iPhone sales. We're not going to get back to the days of iPhone 6 where Apple had record iPhone numbers. I think iPhone 7 again will sell a little bit better, a little bit higher in terms of the numbers than iPhone 6s. But at the end of the day, what's really going to matter is how much money does Apple make on iPhone. And anytime they come out with a new model, you can expect that they're not going to make as much money because component production costs are going to be a little bit higher. I'm not expecting huge numbers out of iPhone 7 toward the end of this year when Apple, lists out their last quarter numbers. But it's not doomsday either. So I think we'll see some of those reports. You know, people are going to want to point to iPhone 7 and say that, oh, here it is, another quarter where iPhone sales are declining. So just be prepared for that. We'll, as always on the MacCast, try and balance things out, give you, the balanced perspective, or at least a rational perspective. It's what I try to do most of the time, and we'll see if we succeed. But I'm very excited about iPhone 7. I'm looking forward to seeing what Apple has put forth. Tim Cook says they're going to give us a reason to really want an iPhone 7. So maybe that will help. And maybe it's the camera system. Maybe it's something else we haven't even heard about yet. And that would be a great surprise. But typically, it looks like going into this, we're going to kind of know what to expect at this point. And now we just have to wait for September. There's been a lot of international news this week, a bunch of short, small stories. And I never kind of know how to handle this stuff. So this week I decided to try and just put everything into one little section here for you. We'll go over a couple quick stories here. Shouldn't take too long, but a lot of things happening with Apple internationally. We'll kick things off with new Apple Smart keyboards for the iPad Pro with layouts for Arabic, British English, and Italian. So we're finally getting some international versions of the iPad Pro Smart keyboards. They're available in both the 9.7 and the 12.9 inch sizes. And you should be able to find those in the Apple retail stores in the respective regions where it would be appropriate. Apple Music has come to Israel. You can now get Apple Music there. They have a 3-month trial, free trial, just like they do everywhere else. Pricing is a $19.90 ILS a month, which is about $5.22 US for individuals, and $29.90 ILS for the family plan, which translates to about $7.85 US. So you're getting quite a deal over there in Israel for Apple Music. Apple Music is now supported in over 110 countries, and Korea is reportedly on the horizon. We've been hearing that Apple Music should be coming to Korea soon, but it just hasn't happened yet. Hopefully it will be in the next couple months or so. And then a little bit of news out of France. I guess there is a new TV option coming to Apple TV for French customers, Molotov TV. It's a freemium service. The free service offers 35 free-to-air channels with 10 hours of on-demand viewing per month. And then if you want to opt in to their paid service, it's €9.99 a month and adds 37 premium channels with up to 100 hours of on-demand viewing. So that sounds pretty cool. I can't get any really free-to-air channels here in the US on my Apple TV without, you know, making some other separate purchase like Sling TV. So sounds like a good deal. I don't know much about Molotov TV. If you happen to be a MacCast listener in France and want to sort of fill us in on the service, I'd welcome a quick audio comment on, you know, is this a cool thing? Is it something that is a big deal in France, or is it just something that us Americans are making a big deal over? But with that, that is kind of it for the international news for this week. And if you liked this segment and would like to see more of it, I'm happy to do more international news. There's stories that pop up from time to time. A lot of them, again, are not very long. So maybe just aggregating them together in sort of a quick This Week in International Apple News segment might be a good way to handle it. And then finally in the news for this week, Recode is reporting that since Apple's plans for a skinny TV bundle service seem to have not worked out, that they're now talking to TV programmers and other video companies about creating a digital TV guide as a kind of alternative or maybe a stopgap. I guess the idea would be to have a built-in guide in Apple TV and on Apple devices that would let you search and play content from across multiple, you know, the multiple channel apps that you might download to your device and do all of that with a single click. And to me, it sounds sort of like what we already have with Siri Search on the new Apple TV. With Siri Search, more and more apps and more channels are being plugged into that. And so I can do a search on my, you know, using Siri on my Apple TV, and I can call up content from HBO, Netflix, ABC, a number of different channels, and it will show me, and I can just say, I want to find comedies, or I want this show, or I want a movie starring Matt Damon, and it will show me all of the places that I can watch that instantly. So this sounds like that, maybe on a bigger scale, maybe with more apps and content providers participating. The report also seems to indicate that Apple may be giving up on its plans to sell TV services and just focusing on a new interface for getting consumers to the content that is offered or sold by other third parties and apps and things that they may have subscribed to. And they note that Apple's single sign-on feature, which they announced at WWDC as part of the update to Apple TV, that may be in there to kind of help consumers who have content from multiple TV provider apps and could funnel right into this kind of TV guide service, because you're not going to want to have to, you know, authorize and open up every cable app that you have just to get this search feature to work. So another thing is that Apple seems to be looking to these content providers to provide a little bit more metadata so that they can make the searching and all of this functionality work better. And it sounds great and wonderful. You know, it sounds like something we would all love to have. It solves a big problem, right? You want to watch something. You don't want to have to go into a dozen different channels or apps to figure out which one has it. I do this all the time now. I've got to go and look on Amazon. I've got to look on Netflix. I've got to look on HBO. You know, what movies do they each have? Is this movie on that service? No. Is it on that service? It's a big pain. So the idea of being able to go to one place, do one search, figure out, you know, what I have available to me to watch and what I can watch, that's great. The trick, of course, for Apple is going to be convincing the content providers that the Apple Guide is going to help them, which might be hard to do because they know what has happened with the discovery challenges of the App Store, right? Because this kind of starts to sound to me like App Store search, but for entertainment. And discovery then becomes a problem because, for example, if I'm going into the HBO app, HBO is able to cross-promote some of their other content to me directly. Now, if I'm going into a generic search that's going to search not just the HBO app, but the Showtime app and Netflix and Amazon and any other TV service that I might have available, HBO is not going to have that marketing opportunity. And same thing, Netflix is not going to have that opportunity. So kind of how they sell these guys on this TV guide system, I think, is going to be a challenge for Apple. But certainly sounds like, you know, the direction they're moving in is, hey, if we can't sell our own bundled TV services, then a great way for us to do this is sort of aggregate to extrapolate the search part of it, the discovery part of it, put that into the operating system or into the Apple TV itself, and then let individuals download the content and the apps and the channels that they want to kind of build out their own custom system. And I think that's a great way to go. So far, it's working well. The search piece and the discovery piece is still a big challenge, and maybe this is the solution for it. And then also, just real quick in TV news, Apple this week also released the new Apple TV remote app. It replaces the iTunes remote app. I think that's what they called it. That they currently have for the older generation Apple TV. It is a separate download. I believe it only works with the latest generation of Apple TV because it's designed to mimic the functionality of the Siri remote. It is also iPhone only, so you can't load it on your iPad, but it does bring in the Siri capabilities, the TV button, all of the functionality that you would get on the Siri remote is built into it. Plus, you get the advantage of when you come to someplace where you need to do text input, you, of course, get the on-screen keyboard. Makes all of that work a little bit easier. And I downloaded the app and tried it. It is great. I really like it. It basically it works as you would expect it to work. So not super exciting, but that is out. Apple showed that off or mentioned it at WWDC, and many of us thought it was going to be part of the next Apple TV update, sort of launched at the same time, but it looks like Apple had it ready earlier and they've put it out and made it available. So you can download that from the App Store now. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, you want to get cash for your old iPhone, iPad, maybe a Mac? Gazelle makes that really easy. They make it free and easy to get an online offer on your old Apple gear. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, answer a few easy questions, and you get an instant price quote. And you don't have to worry if you have a broken device. Gazelle will accept those too. And once you get your offer, Gazelle honors that offer for 30 days. So you really have nothing to lose. And the sooner that you go in to get your offer, the better, especially on an iPhone with new iPhones right around the corner. As we get closer to the release of the iPhone 7, those values are going to go down and down. So you probably want to get in there now, lock in your price for your current iPhone, and that way you can get cash to buy the new one. And they make it super simple, not just in terms of getting your offer, but also in terms of sending in your device. Shipping is free and covered, and in many cases, Gazelle will send you the box to send it in. I've used the service for many of my old iPhones, and it's been great every time. All of your personal information when they receive your device is wiped and removed. You get paid fast. You can get paid by check in the mail, by Amazon gift card, or by direct deposit into your PayPal account. And Gazelle has serviced over 1 million customers. They've paid out over $200 million to those customers. They have great customer service and support, and it just works. So get cash for your old iPhone, iPad, or Mac today. Go to gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. So can an iPad really be your only computer? Can it be the only computing device that you have? And right now you may be thinking to yourself, yes or no? Well, Apple released a great new iPad ad this week, and that's basically what they proposed. The message at the end of the ad is, imagine what your computer could do if your computer was an iPad Pro. And the ad focuses on the accessories, pointing out the smart keyboard and the Apple Pencil, both, as you know, are optional, but you know, you have those two things and you know, you have a pretty darn good computer. But that said, there is this debate. Is that accurate? Can Apple really say that the iPad is a quote unquote computer? And I guess we have to kind of step back and maybe say, well, what is a computer? Is your iPhone a computer? I would argue yes. So by that token, yes, very much so, your iPad can be your computer. And you know, my personal answer to this question, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, so send me some feedback, but I say emphatically, yes, an iPad can be your main and only computer. Of course, it's going to depend on your specific needs, what you're doing for your computing on a daily basis, but most daily computing tasks can be done on an iPad. So I'm talking about things like taking notes, checking email, surfing the web, playing games, you know, doing image processing for photos, doing audio processing, video editing. All of these things can happen on an iPad Pro, and you can do them very effectively. Are you going to be able to do them in exactly the same ways that you do with your quote-unquote traditional computer? No, but if you're willing to be a little bit open, if you're willing to be open-minded, if you're willing to explore a little bit, if you're willing to look at your workflows and maybe be willing and flexible about changing those, I think you really can make it work. And if you want to see a good example of it, follow Federico Vitici over at Mac Stories. He uses an iPad as his main computing platform and has for years. And it's just getting better with things like the iPad Pro and the smart keyboard. I'm using my iPad Pro as my mobile computing device, I would say about 80% of the time. Now, that's not to say there aren't challenges. I think a couple of the main challenges tend to be local storage, but now the iPad Pro does come in a 256 gigabyte configuration, so that kind of helps. I think the bigger challenge is the sandboxing. The operating system is not the same. You don't have a traditional file system, so there are challenges in your workflow with that, but there's now a lot of creative Lightning products and wireless-based external storage solutions that kind of get past some of those challenges as well. So again, if you're willing to think creatively, if you're willing to look at your workflows and change those a little bit, I think you really can make an iPad Pro work. And one thing I'd been wanting to do for a long time is figure out if I could use an iPad Pro to produce this podcast. Could I do the whole thing on an iPad Pro? And I haven't dug in fully, but my last vacation this July, I was able to produce a MacCast members episode completely on the iPad Pro, start to finish, without touching my Mac. And that was great. There's a lot of ways that I could improve the process. It was kind of a painful process to go through because I hadn't really worked out the workflow. I think moving to more cloud-based automation could help that process. And I think that's true of a lot of processes that you might be doing with an iPad Pro. But again, it depends on the kinds of work that you want to do. And no, an iPad is not going to work as a computer for everyone. Certainly not. But I think there's a growing market that the iPad Pro is the perfect solution. And so, well, I guess what I'm proposing, and I think what Apple is proposing in that commercial as well, is let's open our minds a little bit and think, you know, when someone's asking us, should I get a new MacBook? Should I get a new MacBook Air? Look at what their computing tasks are and maybe even consider the iPad as a viable option. And a 12-inch iPad Pro with a smart keyboard, maybe that's the perfect solution for them and they don't need all the extra stuff that comes along with a more traditional computer solution. So I thought it was a pretty good commercial. If you haven't seen it, you can check it out. I think it's on Apple's YouTube channel, on Apple's website. You'll probably see it on TV, especially if you're going to be watching the Olympics. I'm sure it's going to be airing there. And, you know, let's just think about it. And I'd love to get your feedback. Send me some feedback, some thoughts. You know, are you using an iPad Pro or an iPad as your main computing platform? How do you do that? What's had to change? What kinds of things have you had to change in your workflow? What kinds of changes have you had to make in your thinking? I'd love to discuss this a lot more with you. So send those in, mattcast@gmail.com. Now, when Apple announced HomeKit and home automation coming to our Macs and iOS devices, our Apple TVs, a number of us, myself included, got very excited of the idea of Apple taking what has traditionally been a pretty complicated setup and technology and finally making that available to the rest of us, bringing home automation sort of down to earth, making it work easily and simply using HomeKit. And as you may or may not know, that vision that Apple kind of gave us of simple home automation utopia, it's a little bit clouded at this point. It kind of works, it's getting better, but it wasn't this overnight utopia that I think I was hoping for, at the very least. And I often get questions about HomeKit, and this week was no exception. Kevin emailed me. He's building a new house, and he's very interested in setting it up from the ground up with home automation and possibly using HomeKit right from the start. But he had a number of questions. And he basically wants to know, you know, where do I start? How do I do this? Is this even feasible? Is this something I could consider doing? What products should I look at? And, you know, what about security? Because that's another big thing. We're putting in these internet-connected devices. We want to know that they're secure. Someone can't hack in and kind of mess with our stuff. And since I've really only dipped my toe in a little bit on this topic, I have a couple of HomeKit devices. I've played around with, you know, some technologies. I decided to call in some reinforcements. So I called in my friend Ara from the HDTV podcast. If you're a longtime listener to the MacCast, you've heard him on the show before. He's done home automation, everything from custom all the way through HomeKit stuff. And so I grabbed him and we sat down and we kind of tackled Kevin's question. So, hey, Ara, how you doing?
I am doing well. It's a pleasure to talk to you again, Adam. How are things in the Mac world?
Things are great. As you know, we have a question from one of my listeners, Kevin, and I thought no person would be better to help me out than you, you know, since you do the HDTV podcast, but I know you're also well involved in sort of home automation and have been for a while. So I've got a little bit of a HomeKit question for you. So I've kind of already prepped you a little bit, but let me just, for the audience, let me reiterate a couple of these questions. So Kevin's been a MacCast listener for a while. He is buying a new construction home. They're working on it, and he's thinking about home automation. And being an Apple fan, of course, he's very interested in Apple HomeKit and the compatible gear. So he knows about all the products, but he's kind of looking for some help and direction from us. So I'm going to flip the question around a little bit.
Okay.
Because he asks about some security things, and then he is also asking about, hey, if you were starting from scratch like he is, you know, what would be the general recommendation? So if you were going to build a home automation system from scratch today, you know, what would be the recommendation on where to start? I know what I'm thinking, but I'm curious what you're thinking.
Okay, that's, you know, it's a very complex type of question. It depends on what you want. If you want like a full automation home that has all kinds of macros and connectivity outside the world, HomeKit will do that. But if you really want to go to like a professional level, you're going to want to get, DIY products would be like that support the Z-Wave or the Insteon format.
Okay.
And there's a company called Perceptive Automation, and they have a home automation package called Indigo. And that's what I recommend for Mac users. That's what I use. It's very full-featured. You can mix and match Z-Wave and Insteon devices. And you can even, with a home bridge, you can bring in those devices into HomeKit. So you can kind of have the best of everything. And that's exactly what I do.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, my thought on this, well, let's talk about that a little bit, and then I'll talk to you about my thoughts about sort of building out a system. Because I think you're right. I think Kevin, it seems from his email that where he wants to get to is sort of full home automation. He's got this new construction house. He's trying to get to, you know, I want everything kind of interconnected. But being an Apple user, you kind of tend to want to move toward the HomeKit thing. So the question I have for you, because I know we've talked about, and Kevin, I would encourage you to go back and listen to some of the other episodes on the feed with Ara, and maybe even check out Ara's show itself. Because I know, Ara, you and I have kind of covered the Indigo system and sort of right. how you set up that up yes. and how that works. Now, so that's not necessarily HomeKit, but you mentioned Instion. So, you know, one of the things when I started to build out my system was Instion was one of the first companies that came forward and said, yes, we are going to support HomeKit. So I actually ended up buying their Smart Pro Hub and buying Instion in-wall dimmer switches that I put in place when I was redoing the lighting in my living room. And so that's sort of the place that I started. And I'm wondering, you know, for someone like Kevin, I don't know if he's interested in upfront investing, you know, in an entire package like that. We're starting off, and I was going to maybe recommend maybe what you want to do is start off in bits and pieces when you're getting into building a home automation system. You kind of have to forward think, I think you're right, and think about, you know, am I getting all these things that are going to integrate together? So I think your point is very well taken about, well, if you stick with Instion and Z-Wave, you can build in an Indigo system, and then you can add in something like HomeBridge, and you can kind of integrate it all with HomeKit. I think that's a very good way to go. So there's sort of those two philosophies, right? There's sort of, you could build out a whole system in the way that you're recommending, but I think you could also maybe start with something like Instion and go, okay, I'm going to do some Instion switches, dimmer switches and lights, maybe start with the lighting and then sort of start to add in things as you go. You just have to be, I think, really careful, and correct me if I'm wrong, really careful about kind of the platforms that you're picking, because integrating all together is the challenge. And that's sort of what I think Apple was trying to sell with HomeKit, that it's going to solve this integration problem, but it doesn't feel like that's a reality right now.
Well, you know what? They're very close to making that happen. I agree. So to answer the question for the listener, if he really wants a sophisticated home automation, he's going to need something probably more than HomeKit.
Right.
And that doesn't mean it's not compatible with HomeKit. You can make it work. And I think your approach is very true. Start out with something that you can build on. For instance, you mentioned the Instion controller. You can start with that. And then if, let's say, you outgrow that, you can just take the controller out and then switch over to right. Indigo. So you're good there. I like that concept of starting small, working out. Now, if you're just kind of like, you know, I want to be able to turn on some lights. When I watch TV, I want to hit one button and have all the lights in, you know, the area dim to what I want. HomeKit is great for that. And there's a lot of different products that do support HomeKit that you'll be able to get it to work. And quite frankly, I was surprised how well these disparate products work with HomeKit.
Yeah. Are you using HomeBridge? Because this is another thing that I've covered on the show. So again, Kevin, I would go back and listen to the HomeBridge thing. But this is basically some open source software that you can run on a Mac, or maybe I'm running it on a Raspberry Pi. And it acts as a bridge between HomeKit and non-HomeKit systems and even HomeKit systems.
Right.
You know, you might find that some hubs and things like that don't function the way you'd really like them to. Anybody can kind of write plugins for HomeBridge that kind of connect those separate devices. So, for example, I've been able to integrate my Nest thermostat, which isn't a HomeKit compatible product, with my HomeKit system and can control it from Siri using HomeBridge.
Right. And yeah, and that actually, that's pretty cool. The I lost track, but here's what I wanted to say. The Instion hub that you were talking about,
yeah.
what Instion people did was they implemented a HomeBridge-like driver in that hub, because their devices are not HomeBridge compatible. But what
HomeKit
happens
compatible,
is,
you mean.
Yeah, what happens is this device says, okay, I have 5 switches on here, and I know what HomeKit is expecting, so right. I'm just going to broadcast as if they are HomeKit devices. So it'll translate it, and that's exactly what HomeBridge does. The difference is it'll run on, like you said, in your case, a Raspberry Pi, and in my case, just on a Macintosh. So that's kind of what some manufacturers are doing to get that backwards compatibility, because overnight, devices that I had plugged into my system 3 years before there was a HomeKit were HomeKit enabled. So I really like that bridge technology that allows it, and I'm surprised how well it works.
Yeah, and it really is going to vary dependent upon the implementation and the device. I want to be very clear, you know, in a lot of cases, the software that comes from the manufacturer or the software that's specifically designed or the hubs that are specifically designed for that piece of equipment tend to offer more functionality or maybe more advanced functionality in a lot of cases than the HomeBridge stuff. But if you just need basic controls, if you want to throw it into a scene and sort of bring everything together so that you can have one command where you have a number of things happening, you know, that really works well. But, you know, as far as building a home automation system from scratch, I don't know. I think that's really a tricky question. I think you hit the nail on the head when you started this whole thing, Ara, is unless you're going to go with a proven, you know, known technology like the one you recommended, you know, and you want to go all HomeKit, I just don't know that I would invest a whole bunch of money in HomeKit like today. Maybe 6 months from now, maybe a year from now when there's more products on the market and there's a little bit more support. I think iOS 10 and macOS Sierra are going to bring some changes, and we don't know what's happening with Apple TV. I think it's still a little bit in flux. So I think I would start really small if I were somebody like Kevin. Again, I'd maybe look at, you know, I think Insteon Lights, they've worked out pretty well for me, and it sounds like then you have some options, right? So he's talking about new construction. So I'm assuming, Kevin, what you're considering is in-wall dimmer switches, in-wall lighting controls and stuff like that. A lot of the other products, and then maybe a thermostat. You know, maybe you want to have that integrated and you want to have that installed along with the home. But, you know, other things like smoke detectors or security cameras or a lot of these other products, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ara, they don't have to be sort of wired in, right? They don't have to be built in necessarily to your house.
None of my stuff was built in as right. The house was built, obviously. I moved in, I think, 15 years after the house was built. But you can add the switches later. I'm not an electrician, but it's really easy to
do
it. I trust myself to do it. Just make sure you cut the power so you can't electrocute yourself, and then it's really simple.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, it's always great to have an electrician wire up your devices because the incremental cost is nothing. It's just the cost of you right. providing him the switches. So I think going with Insteon in that case is going to be your best bet because you can use HomeKit. And if you decide not to, or let's say HomeKit goes away, you can switch over to various other controllers. I would love to see Z-Wave do it, but see them come up with a controller that works with the HomeKit, but I haven't seen that yet. Yeah. Now, I will say one thing. With my Indigo, they won't control Z-Wave locks because there's some sort of encryption issue that the developers of Indigo say there is. I don't know the details of it. So what I did was I bought a Schlage lock, which was HomeKit enabled, and I put that in, and I can actually tell Siri, unlock my front door, and it unlocks it. So it's really right. cool. And I don't mind having my Indigo software and my HomeKit running together because what I find is I use Siri with my HomeKit. So I'll say Siri movie, set home for movie mode, and it will dim the lights. And that I don't get with Indigo, but I do get with HomeKit. So these things work well in parallel.
Great. Yeah. So that I'd say continue to do your research, Kevin. Maybe start with, you know, since you're doing new construction, look at the things that are going to matter for you already have an electrician on hand, you know, because that's sort of what I did when I put my switches on. I could have done it myself, I think, you know, just like Ara pointed out, but I was already having an electrician coming in to do this other work. So he didn't order the switches. I had to order them, but I just handed to him and said, these are the ones I want you to install when you hook up the lights. And he did that. And I would imagine you could do something very similar.
Yeah.
And, you know, Insteon is HomeKit compatible, and it sounds like it's compatible with the system you're recommending, Aura. Do you know, the only other sort of in-wall product that I think that I'm aware of that's HomeKit compatible is Lutron. And I don't know if you're familiar with them or not.
Yeah, and that is, and then, so I can't remember if the Wemo was actually in-wall or not. I know they have plugs, but I don't know if that they have switches or not. But
they might have in-wall at this point. You may want to look into that one as well.
More products are coming online. Eve, which is from Elgato, has these really cool sensors. They'll tell you the temperature. They'll tell you the, the carbon monoxide, or, you know, they'll tell you what the state of your home is as far as like, oh, you need to open up some windows or something. And that's pretty cool. I wish they would have motion included in that, but maybe someday in the future.
Yeah. And again, I think a lot of these are sort of aftermarket products that you can add in. As far as I know, compatibility, the only thermostat, and that might be the other thing you want to look at that I know of that's compatible, is the Echo Bee. I don't remember if there, Honeywell also makes.
Yeah, I had both. I had the Honeywell. I uninstalled it after about a week. I wrote their customer service. Terrible customer service, and they said, oh no, there's a problem with HomeKit. And I told them, how come all my other devices are working? Yours is the only one that isn't. So I pulled it out, bought an Echo Bee, and never looked back. The Echo Bee is a fantastic thermostat.
Yeah, I think it's a much better designed one too. I was never impressed with the look of the Honeywell Lyric. Yeah, it just felt like a cheap version of the Nest.
Exactly. And the Echo Bee's got some great stats on your usage. And they do have remote sensors that will tell you the temperature in the remote rooms, and they work in conjunction. So if you want to have the upstairs house at a certain upstairs portion of the house at a certain temperature, it will actually fire your thermostat sooner than it would, because, you know, if in my case, I've got a two-story, the downstairs is cooler than the upstairs. So it works out pretty cool.
Yeah, I would just definitely ease into HomeKit at this point. I don't think I'd jump in with both feet yet.
That's the beauty of it. Buy one device. Don't put a big cash outlay. See how it works. If it works well, add the next one. And before you know it, you've got your house set up. I mean, it'd take a few months, but I guarantee you the best thing to do is start out with a light switch, because that's so simple. On, off, or dim, and work your way up.
The only thing that that bothered me about some of the aftermarket, and this is the last thing I want to say because I want to get to the other question real quick, about the in-wall light switches, and this is really going to depend on your family. So they have, you know, the plug-in switches, which Insteon.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's what I meant. The plug-in switch.
The little plug-in switches are great. Here's the only problem, though. If you're powering a lamp or something like that, and I didn't really think about this, and it makes sense once I had it and was playing around with it. I never really thought about it. The way it works is you plug this thing into the wall, you turn the lamp on, right, so that it's on, and then you use your smartphone or your iPhone or HomeKit to turn the lamp on and off. But you have to remember, now from that point forward, pretty much you have to use the app. Now, the little switch that I have did have a button on the plug-in, you know, like on the side, where you could power the lamp on and off, and that would obey the sort of HomeKit, so that you would see that in HomeKit. But there's no way my wife is going to reach down behind the sofa, you know, to manually turn on and off the lamp. She's going to want to turn the little knob on the lamp, and then it becomes out of sync with your HomeKit system. So at that point, you know, now on is off and off is on, and it never worked for me. So I'm kind of more of a fan of the in-wall if you're going to do it.
You know, I got you. But you see, here's the flip side of that. In my house, I have six lamps, and I don't think anyone has turned a switch on those lamps in 6 years, because
they'll use the app.
Well, no, I use it all on timer.
Oh.
So I have the lights come on at sunset, and you can do that with HomeKit. That's the beauty of it. Sunset changes every day. You never have to change the day that
you've
sunset.
You've automated it. That's the way to go. Maybe that's where my failure is.
Yeah, and then once in a while, if we're downstairs and a light goes off because we're up a little bit later, I just turn it on with the app. So, and the other thing is, use Siri. Just hit the button, say, Siri, turn on, you know, table lamp, and boom, it's on.
Yeah, I don't know. So I think that's going to be a little dependent on how tech savvy your family is and what they're willing to do. But I just wanted to point that out, because it is a little dilemma that I didn't think about when I first installed the switch. It's like, oh yeah, somebody walked in the room, they turned the lamp off, and now it's in the opposite mode of what I'm expecting it to be. And actually, if you turn the power off of the switch, the lamp's not going to come on even if you flip it with HomeKit.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just Just something to think about. So somewhat related to that, I guess this is quasi-related to that, because the next question was really about security. And that was, I think this is the bigger question, and this is where I think HomeKit has a big advantage, but also a disadvantage, right? Is he says, you know, how do I know if I do all this automation that my house is secure? How do I know someone's not going to hack in through the internet and start turning my lamps on and off or changing my thermostat or doing all this stuff, right?
Yeah, the good news there is the devices themselves have a very high level of encryption. And in fact, that's almost to the detriment. There's a few companies that wanted to bring their product to HomeKit, but this encryption was so stringent that they couldn't do that. The other aspect of it is, it's your house. Don't share your password with anybody, because let's say I get on your home share, Adam, and I get my phone, and now all of a sudden I can start controlling it. So there's a little bit of password security that you need to deal with. And you can give guest accounts, which is kind of cool. So if you want to give it to your kids, you can give them a guest account. And I think that ties through the family share, but I'm not 100% sure on that. But rest assured, the security is actually very good. Yeah. And it's unlikely that someone's going to be able to control your home without you allowing it.
And unlike some of the other systems out there, I mean, this is kind of a HomeKit thing. Apple really puts security first. And as Ara pointed out, somewhat to the detriment, because some of the slow rollout of some of these other products is happening because, as you just mentioned, some companies are having trouble with the security. They're having trouble implementing the security. I think the two requirements that Apple required was encryption keys that are 3072-bit keys, which is super, super strong encryption. And then they're also using these elliptical curve digital signatures. I have no idea what that means, an exchange encrypted keys, but I mean,
nor do I.
Yeah, it's like,
but it sounds good.
Curve 25519, you know, is something that was reported, I think, in Forbes. The point is like, it's really locked down. So as long as you're using good, strong passwords and you're not giving those away, as Ara pointed out, then you should be okay. And you can set up, you know, if you have guests coming in, you can set up guest accounts and you can kind of manage that stuff. So if you're sticking with HomeKit, I don't think you need to worry. Now, if you're using some other system, there has been a lot on the internet about Internet of Things and the lack of security in a lot of various systems. But again, sticking with HomeKit compatible products, I think you're going to be okay, Kevin. So I think that's it. I think that answers all of his questions.
Great.
Unless you have anything else to add.
No, I really like it. I know you're right for being cautious, but you know I live on the hairy edge, so I kind of jump in.
I'm enjoying it. I mean, it's working a lot better. Since I installed the HomeBridge, that seems to have smoothed out a lot of the issues that I had been having, even with some of the some of the devices that were supposedly HomeKit compatible. And some of that, too, may be that Insteon's been pretty good about pushing updates to the hub. Now, I only have a few products. I haven't added in door locks. And I guess another thing that Kevin asked about that we haven't addressed yet is video cameras. And as far as I know, until iOS 10 comes out, and I don't even know if it's rolled into iOS 10 or if it's just going to be rolled out separately, I don't believe there are any home security cameras that are compatible.
No, not yet. And so I have a bunch of Wi-Fi cameras in my house that will probably become obsolete. And I'll probably swap some out, because it'll be kind of cool to, I think, talk to Siri and say, bring up my dining room camera. I'm hoping it'll be that easy and it'll just pop up on screen.
Yeah, the Canary is the one that Apple sells, I think, in their retail stores. And I want to go out on an edge and say they announced that they're planning HomeKit compatibility, but it will probably require new hardware. Because again, I think part of the security that I read about is there may even be a chip in some of the hardware products that has to be in there to support the higher level.
And I'll be honest, I'll prefer that because I'll prefer that because my cameras, I've read so much about how poor the security is on the Wi-Fi cameras. Fortunately, in my home, I've got them aimed at door entries, so they're not going to see anything. I'm not worried about that. But it would still be nice to have that security where nobody else could see it. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm sure I'll pay for it, but sometimes you got to pay to get that kind of stuff.
Encryption is key. But there you go, Kevin. And Ara, so I mentioned it already, but please let people know you're kind of really into this stuff. I know you started out as HD home theater and you still cover that, but you also cover home automation as well on your podcast, right? So
yeah,
you can tell people about your podcast and how they can follow you and stuff like that.
So, yeah, so you can find us at HT Guys. In the old days, we called that Home Theater Guys, but somebody made a comment. You know what? That could also stand for Home Tech Guys, because we cover more than just home theater. Now, as Adam said, we do cover the automation, and sometimes we'll even get into some stuff that's just not even home theater, but it's kind of tech for the house. That's very rare, but it's our wheelhouse is home theater and HDTVs and 4K stuff. So you can find us at htguys.com. And I do have some videos on YouTube. You can just search for The HT Guys. That's our YouTube username. And I will be producing shortly a video on using Siri to control my home. I did one. Awesome. It's already up there for Amazon Alexa, and you can go see that. I left it up there, warts and all. There were some issues with it, but I didn't want to edit it. I wanted everyone to see the real how it worked, and I'll be doing the same thing with Siri.
Excellent. I'm sure Siri will have a few warts too, as she often does. Awesome. Well, thank you, Ara, for helping me out with this question.
Great. My pleasure.
There you go, Kevin. I hope that helps answer your question, or at least give you some direction to move in. And I do have a link to the Indigo home automation system in the show notes at maccast.com for you. Now I want to get into, as I promised at the top of the show, a new feature in macOS Sierra that Apple announced, and that is optimized storage. You know, SSDs and flash storage, they have this big advantage of speed, right? And all new Macs are using flash storage, and many of us have upgraded our systems with SSDs. But as anyone who has one of these knows, the disadvantage over traditional hard drives is typically storage size. You do not get as much storage for the same price, and that usually results in situations where you're running out of space on your Mac. And Apple obviously recognizes this as an issue, because one of the big new features they announced in macOS Sierra was specifically designed to kind of handle this. And they announced it, they showed it off in their WWDC announcement. But when they did, I had really been left with more questions than really answers about optimized storage. And so I wanted to dig in. Now, luckily, the folks over at iMore kind of helped out a little bit with this. But the first thing that I wanted to cover is, how do you actually access the optimized storage options? So Apple kind of showed some screenshots, but they didn't really talk about how you would actually go in and manage optimized storage. And it's kind of weird where they put it. It's found in the About Mac section. So when you go into the Apple menu and you say About This Mac, right, you get that little panel, the little information panel, and then there's a storage tab in there. You go to the storage tab, and there's now a new button that says Details. And when you click on that, it will give you several options to kind of help you manage the storage that's on your drive. And several of the options in there, I think, are pretty straightforward. They have an optimized storage option, which when you turn that on, what it'll do is it automatically removes any watched TV shows and movies from iTunes. Because if you've purchased movies, or you've watched movies or TV shows or rentals or something like that, you can re-download those. So it will only, it will watch, and when you finished watching, it will automatically delete that. And it also only keeps recent email attachments locally. So when you turn that on, those features are enabled. Then there's an erase trash automatically option. That, again, is pretty straightforward, in that what it'll do is automatically remove items from your trash that are older than 30 days old. So if you're not the kind of person who's in the habit of constantly emptying their trash, you can throw stuff in there and know that anything older than 30 days is automatically going to get removed from there. And then there's a reduce clutter option, which is you can click on, and then it will give you kind of a report. It will expose the older files and documents that are on your Mac, so you can kind of see, oh, there's a bunch of old files in this area. There's a bunch of things in here that I want to be able to archive and clean up. It'll show you different ways for organizing those. So like by file size, you can look for large files that are old that maybe you want to move off onto a backup system or onto a flash drive or something like that, and get those off your computer, free up space. So all of those to me, seem to make sense. They're pretty straightforward. Now, the most baffling one in there, though, was something called Store in iCloud. And what this does is it offers to save space on your drive by storing all of your files and photos in iCloud and on your Mac. But when you start to run out of space on your Mac, when space is needed on your Mac, what it'll do is it will remove the older local files from the Mac, just leaving them in iCloud storage. Okay? And as a backup-obsessed dude, which I am, and one who only has minimal amounts of iCloud storage, like I don't have a lot, and most people are just going to have the free 5 gigabytes, right, that Apple gives you, it left me with a lot of questions. Like, how is this all going to work? What happens with my backups? What if this stuff is only up in the cloud? It doesn't appear like I really have control over it. It's just going to decide, oh, you're running out of space on your drive, and automatically start, you know, removing local files, leaving stuff in the cloud. Well, again, luckily the folks at iMoron, I'll have a link to their full article at maccast.com. They stepped in with a little bit of help. And the first thing that they pointed out, and I kind of already mentioned this, is that as long as your Mac's SSD drive is not completely full and you have this Store in iCloud feature turned on, it's actually going to only make copies of your files into iCloud. It's also going to keep the files stored locally. And when it does start having to purge files to make room, it starts with the older files first. I think that was pretty straightforward. What wasn't straightforward is if it starts deleting the files, is it going to get rid of the references? I mean, what's it going to look like? And they said, well, really what happens is the file names and things are still there locally. And I would assume like the search index and all of that is also still there locally. So your Spotlight index, so you can find these files. So when you're looking at your Mac, you're going to see everything just as if the files were there locally. And then when you go to access them or click on them, they will get re-downloaded if they're only stored in iCloud. Now, it doesn't necessarily explain what happens if I don't have internet access. I would assume if you don't have internet access, you're trying to access an old file that had been purged and is only stored in iCloud, you're going to get some sort of error message, which could be really convenient if it's that critical file you need at a given moment. So that's a little concern I still have with this feature. But they did also point out that the files do not sync. So the way that the Store in iCloud option works is different than if you're using iCloud Drive. Many of us are familiar with iCloud Drive. That's the feature we can turn on our Macs now, where you have this special drive, iCloud Drive, and different apps can put files in there, and they're synced between all of your Macs and all of your iOS devices. That's a syncing thing. So it goes up to iCloud, it goes down to all your other devices. You make a change on any one place, it goes to that other place. Store in iCloud is not that. Store in iCloud is specific to the single Mac that you have it turned on in. And that's important to note, because if you're using this feature, it also means that you cannot grab a file that was uploaded by Store in iCloud on your Mac from another Mac or another iOS device. That is exclusively the domain of iCloud Drive. So you'll use iCloud Drive for syncing your files. Store in iCloud is really just about saving storage. And finally, and most important, according to iMore, I think, is they say because the Store in iCloud feature is not syncing, it does not count against your iCloud storage plan. So this one I find a little bit hard to believe. If that is true, that is awesome, because that means no one's going to have to worry about turning on this feature and then suddenly having all of their iCloud storage eaten up, their free 5 gigabytes, and being forced to buy a larger storage plan. Now, that said, I reached out to the person who wrote the article at iMore, and she got back to me on Twitter and said the only way she's verified this is she's running the beta, which has this feature, and in turning it on after the files had uploaded, she's not seeing any extra storage used on her iCloud. Now, again, it's beta, so they could be storing these files on a beta server or someplace else, so it's not really clear. Macworld ran a separate story, and they believe that you would have to pay for additional storage if you start to store a lot of files up there. And that really left me with a myriad of other unanswered questions, which one of them specifically was, well, when I turn on Store in iCloud, what is actually stored up there? Apple says all files and photos, but all files and photos from where? And in the settings for the feature, it has a little more clarity. So it mentions that all of the files from your desktop and your documents folders are the ones that are going to be uploaded. When it comes to photos and videos, they are the ones that are in your iCloud photo library. And this actually appears to be the same setting. And actually, a lot of these settings seem to already exist in other places on the Mac. Really, what this new optimized storage feature is doing is kind of consolidating the settings all into kind of one screen. So you may already know that in iTunes, I think you can set up to have your watched TV shows and movies automatically removed, or at least your rentals, I think. So maybe it extends that feature a little bit more. Emptying the trash. Some of these things I think you can set in other places. And they also note for like turning off some features like the erase trash automatically, there's no toggle to turn it off in the optimized storage place. Once you've turned it on, you have to turn it off from the Finder settings. So these are really toggles and controls that are settings in other places. And so with the Store in iCloud, at least when it comes to photos and videos, this seems to just be leveraging and using the iCloud photo library storage. And so that goes back to this other question about, would I have to buy more storage? And I know with iCloud photo library, I did have to buy more storage in order to be able to store all my photos. So it's really unclear at this point if we're going to have to pay for that storage. I can't imagine that Apple's just going to let us have that for free, especially if it's storing everybody's desktop and documents folder. That's going to be a lot of free data storage. I would love it if that turns out to be the case, but I'm really not expecting it. And then it also does note in the settings that you can adjust the preferences for storage in system preferences and inside photos for the store and iCloud options. So again, this is something that is starting to bother me a little bit about some of the things that Apple is doing. And this feels like a very Microsoft way of doing things, where I have settings and controls that can be controlled from multiple places. And I'm seeing this on iOS and I'm seeing this on the Mac. And it gets very, very confusing when you have a toggle or a switch or a setting or an option that you're setting in two different places, because oftentimes you don't realize that it's the same setting. And you may be turning something off in one location, not realizing exactly what you're doing. You know, Apple always had this sort of philosophy that everything should be simple. There should be one place for doing something. And they seem to be moving further and further away from that. And it's a little concerning to me. So I was kind of upset to see that the iCloud photo library settings are the same ones that are in this new feature. And then last thing that I'm concerned about, where I really didn't get an answer to this question, is what about backups? So if I've enabled this feature and it uploads a file to iCloud and then removes the local one but leaves the pointer in place, I'm assuming that's some sort of alias, but what are my backups going to do? Specifically, like my cloned backups, Time Machine, is it going to just back up the alias and not actually back up the file and potentially overwrite a file that I've already backed up? That would be really bad. That would not be something that I would want to have happen, because you could then have a crash, go to restore, thinking that there should be a file there, not realizing that it had uploaded to iCloud and then purged the local file, and suddenly what you're getting back, all you're getting back is an alias. Now, I would assume if you restore the alias, it would still point to the iCloud thing and you could get it back, but you can see my dilemma. So I'd like some answers in terms of how the backups for this feature work. So obviously at this point, you know, you have to take all these questions and thoughts with a grain of salt. They're a little bit rhetorical because macOS Sierra is still in beta. It's not out. But I'm hoping that at some point Apple will give us a little more detail or a little bit more information about this feature. It might not come until they actually release it, which is typically how it goes. But I'll continue to kind of watch and ask questions and share as much information with you as I can before the release of macOS Sierra. But that's a little details on the new optimized storage feature in the next OS. Okay, finally, the last thing that I have for you today is my thing of the moment. I actually found this through a Mac Stories article who found, they found it through a post by Jason Snell at Six Colors, and I think it was actually posted by someone else. So I don't know the whole chronology of finding this website, and a bunch of places reported on it this week, but it's still really cool. So I wanted to share it with you in case you missed it. It's called HeySiri.io, HeySiri.io. And it's a site that lists all the Siri commands that you can ask Siri, and it's sorted into categories. And then within each category and within some of the commands, you can actually click on different variations to see how you can kind of tweak that command to get slightly different results or the different places you can kind of use that command. So there's things like conversion commands and math and options and settings and messaging commands and all those sorts of things. Then what's really cool about this is it's a really nice, handy guide to have all in one place. Apple kind of has the feature inside Siri that's like, you know, tries to tell you what you can ask, but it's kind of hard to navigate through. And this website makes it very easy and accessible. And as much as I like it and as cool as I think it is, at the same time, its existence to me kind of shows the amount of work that Apple still needs to go through with Siri's AI, because Siri needs to be much better, I think, about parsing and understanding what we're asking of her. You know, it needs more context in the engine and more artificial intelligence so that we don't have to have a list of very specific words and commands that we have to give in order for Siri to understand and comprehend and do the things that we're asking. So has a long way to go. I know we're asking a lot of Siri at this point, but I think we're getting there. You can see a lot of the technologies, a lot of the companies Apple has invested in and brought on board in the areas of artificial intelligence and stuff like that, I think show that they're thinking about Siri in the same way. But for now, we've got a great website like HeySiri.io, and that's HeySiri.io if you want to check it out. And then one other quick honorable mention, because as I record this, we're just about to get to opening ceremonies of the Olympics, the Summer Olympics in Rio. And if you're in the U.S. and you're looking for a way to watch the games and you're a cable cutter like me, I was looking at this, and you can do it through NBC.com, but they're doing it in Flash, and it looks like it's time restricted and all that stuff, and I really wanted a way to be able to watch the games on my Apple TV. Well, Sling TV at sling.com actually has a plan that is a service you can sign up for, and you can get live coverage, live TV watching of NBC, NBC Sports, and a bunch of other channels, A&E, Bravo. There's a whole list. They have a $25 a month package where you get a whole bunch of channels, but NBC is included in that, so that's going to allow me to watch the Olympic Games on my Apple TV. And best of all, the service is no contract, so you could just sign up for $25 just for this month and then cancel. You can also, I guess there's more coverage for the Olympics on CNBC and MSNBC, and those are an add-on package to this. So for another $5, so for $30 for the month, you could get full coverage of the entire Olympic Games live streaming to televisions in the U.S. I don't know if Sling TV operates outside the U.S. You'll have to check into that. But they also have a 7-day free trial. So if you just want to try it out, you can sign up, try it out for 7 days. If it's not working for you or you're not getting the coverage that you want, then you can simply cancel it. And right now it looks like it is only live streaming coverage. And you can maybe go back a little bit again for a timed period, more like the NBC.com app. It's not looking like they're offering any on-demand coverage, which is really what I would love to have. But for me, this is going to work and get me through the Olympic Games. I plan to use it and then just simply cancel because it is no contract. So secondary pick, Sling TV at sling.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Smile, makers of TextExpander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also TextExpander for iOS, along with PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment, a question for me, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, I welcome your comments and your emails, your audio comments and emails. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You're also welcome to leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page, that's at facebook.com/themaccast. Or if you're on Google Plus, we do have a Google Plus community at google.com/plusmaccast. But that's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.